Right. We're in Isaiah 3. Let's take our Bibles and turn there. If you have your outlines with you, most of you should have them. If you'll pull them out, just take a peek at where we're at. Remember, chapters 1 through 6 are the Lord's indictment against Judah. Of course, that'll continue in a different vein, but we subtracted that into four groupings, the heading being a grouping in and unto itself in verse 1 of chapter 1. But then the rest of the chapter has the Lord's lawsuit against Judah, framed very much as a court of law situation. And you have the accusation that you're not living up to the Mosaic law. You have instructions on how to make it right. And then, of course, you have verses 21 through 23, a lament over the situation because of what they've become, harlots, murderers, leaders on the take, whatnot, and then a declaration of the sentence. And then you have, opening with chapter 2, you have the Lord's affirmation of his restoration, which really telescopes into the future, millennial reign of Christ. And of course, remember, you have the identical information given in Micah chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. Then you have an extended discussion on an excursus on Judah's present condition and their future consequences that will be. And chapter 2, he likens them to pagan peoples in verses 6 through 11. And then he opens up a discussion. We have the first introduction to the term the day of the Lord. If I was to ask you, what is the day of the Lord? Can you give me the parameters of that day, eschatologically, Lou? Yep, it's the tribulation and the millennium, actually. Yes, it's the tribulation and the millennium. It is the rapture that has to happen before the day of the Lord. And so it's important to understand the difference between the day of the Lord and, say, the day of Christ. Those are different things. Although I had a long discussion today with an old student of mine that I was so thrilled to hear he's teaching and God's using him in the church he's in. But he pointed out 2 Thessalonians 2:2, where he came across the phrase the day of Christ, and the context didn't seem to fit the rapture. And I got so involved in his dilemma that I actually spent a half hour looking at it myself, and we had a longer discussion than I anticipated about that exegetical dilemma. Nevertheless, you do have those differences. That brings us to chapter 3, okay, which is still right in the middle, in the heart of the discussion on the present condition of Judah and what will happen to her in the future. And chapter 3 is divided into two parts, very evenly. First 15 verses have to do with the Lord taking into consideration the things that they have done. And then verses 16 right to the end of the chapter, verse 24, I believe, has to do with the attitude that was behind those actions. Okay, so you have an indictment for actions and an indictment for attitudes. And interestingly enough, it almost perfectly splits amongst those two categories. God takes the men to task in the first part, first 15 verses, and then in the last half of the chapter, he takes the women to task. So it's really an interesting division and unbelievably done. In chapter 3, Isaiah is put on display all of his holy eloquence, all of his rich vocabulary, as he enumerates essentially what some commentators have called the 12 supporting pillars that they were banking on for their own ridiculous security, of course, all of it apart from the Lord. And these pillars, God says, are going to be snatched away in his anger and causing the country to end up in just complete and total disarray. Look at the first verse. He says, "For behold, the Lord of hosts, doth take away from Jerusalem and Judah the stay and the staff." Those two words are actually very, they're actually of the same Hebrew root with different different genders, and it became a colloquialism for whatever it is that you're the stuff that you're made out of. I'm going to knock it out from underneath you. So it became that colloquialism. But notice the whole stay of bread and the whole stay of water. Now, bread and water are the chief means that people essentially stay alive with. They are support things. And just like the old man leans on his stick and the shepherd will be supported by his staff, so a people lean for their natural sustenance on bread and water. And I don't think anybody would dispute that. So hence, you have the expression that you see in verse 1, the stay of bread and the stay of water, which bespeaks, I think, famine. Okay, God will send a famine, and already the law of Moses had made that clear, that that would be one of the penalties for disobedience. God devotes a pretty good significant portion of Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 on that idea, and those passages in particularly contained a threat of a terrible famine that would occur because of a willful, prolonged disobedience from God's law. But actually, we know that from the history of the destruction of Samaria and then later on Jerusalem, we know that those threatenings were very literally fulfilled, to the degree that several times in Israel's history, she became guilty of cannibalism to a smaller degree. But the Lord is going to take further away from Judah by the sword or by exile into foreign countries, or really by both at the same time. Notice in verse 2, the mighty man, the gibor. The gibor was David's mighty men were the giborim in Hebrew. The guys that that the country really was banking their defense on, and their strength. So the mighty man of war, that's the professional soldier, the judge and the prophet and the prudent and the ancient, they're all going somewhere, you see. But let's just take them as they come. So we got pillars we're talking about now, right? The mighty man and the man of war. Those are two supporting pillars that represent the entire army, basically, of the Jews, in which a people will normally put their trust so that their country can be defended. Then notice the judge and the prophet. That represents the civil rulers and the spiritual rulers, because Judah was, they were supposed to be a theocracy, but of course that went by the wayside fairly quickly. Then the third couplet, you have the prudent and the ancient. That represents the wise counselors, the ones who were basically the dispensers of wisdom in the land, the ones that the people trusted. And then the others mentioned here indicate the leaders of the nation in verse 3. The captain of 50 and the honorable man and the counselor and the cunning artificer and the eloquent orator. You see, at that, here's the deal. What's going on here? At that time, when Isaiah was writing, and even after that, it was the custom, really all over the world, usually, for the conquerors to carry away the captive leaders. They would put the king in a cage and parade him in a victory procession back to their own country. And that would serve a twofold purpose, as the people, the captive people, would usually follow behind. First of all, they would establish a colonial system that prevented the danger of an uprising. And then second, that kind of a choice group of colonists could reclaim very fruitful but wild areas, let's say, for their conquerors. And so the kings of Assyria and of Babylon, they applied that system perfectly, right to Israel and then later to Judah, just as Kings and the Chronicles tell us. That brings us to verses 4 and 5, which reminds me of a proverb that Solomon said, or wrote. Solomon said, "Woe to thee, O land, when thy king is a child." And that's where God was going to reduce these people to. that proverb I think, describes verses 4 and 5 at least. Verses 1 through 3 said that Judah is going to be robbed of its best rulers. The best people that they had were going to be taken from them. But now here, Isaiah predicts, really speaking for the Lord, that these young and extremely inexperienced leaders are going to take their place, you see. Very inexperienced young men and even children are going to have authority over the people. Notice in verse 4, I will give children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them. Now notice that the word king is intentionally avoided here, but I think most likely, who do you think Isaiah is referring to? Can you think of a young, Manasseh in particularly. Manasseh, when his father died, Hezekiah, Manasseh was only 12 years old. Can you imagine a 12-year-old being president of the United States? Not really. So as a result of the misrule by very rash young men, arguably even worse than the kind that befriended Rehoboam, remember his punk friends? So these are going to be the people running the show now, you see. And so the confusion will increase. But notice the people are going to be oppressed. They're going to be pressured. They're going to be vexed out of their minds. And that would be the first result, with the second one being that the civil war would ensue. They're not only going to be attacked but from without, but they're also going to fly at each other's throats, you see. And then thirdly, it'd be a time of Bolshevism. Remember the Bolshevik Revolution, 1917? The Russians came in and upended and pronounced a hard-line communism. That was the Bolshevik Revolution. That's what God promised would be the penalty. See, if people only read the Bible, man, it would just be amazing what could be avoided. But all authority, all obedience, all submissiveness, totally out the window. Completely disappeared. Notice verse 5, and the people shall be oppressed, every one by another, and every one by his neighbor. The child shall behave himself proudly against the ancient. That means disrespectful, punk kids will have absolutely zero respect for authority. And they'll do this against the ancient, and the base against the honorable. So that which was good and respectable will be viewed as some kind of a sickening menace, and that which is raunchy and disrespectful and downright rotten will be elevated to a place of respect. The rabble will rule the roost. And, you know, occasionally in history you see a little bit of evidences of that, and then what happens when that actually comes to fruition. All right, that brings us to verses 6 and 7, with all the disruption and despair that occurs during a time of total anarchy, which is what this essentially is. Notice verse 6. When a man shall take hold of his brother of the house of his father, saying, thou hast clothing, be thou our ruler, and let this ruin be under thy hand. And so what Isaiah is doing is he's introducing basically a symbolic act. And really now he moves from a narrative to a dialogue now. People are having a discussion. And the prophet, in a very few words, he's just sketching out the hopeless confusion that results when God is basically kicked out of his place and his service becomes no more. In verse 6, you see the word brother. It's a reference to their fellow citizens. And then the house of his father is another general reference to the country, all right, and the people. So the situation is depicted as so bad, so utterly desolate, that no one would even be willing to accept the reins of the highest positions of government were it just handed to them. No, I don't want it. You know, now today you see these commercials on TV now against Dino Rossi and this Schreier woman, and they're paying millions of dollars to air these things for just 30 seconds, and they're trying to win an election. But in that day, people will just say, "Hey, be somebody big," And they'll just say, no, nobody considers it possible to even come close to saving the totally collapsed state as they see it. And yet the people realize that there has to be a government, and so they do their level best to find somebody, anybody, willing to provide leadership. And in this general horrendous poverty, somebody still has a piece of clothing on. I mean, it's so bad, most of them are unclothed. And they found somebody with a little bit of clothing, which might be a metaphor there. Most of the scholars think that that's a metaphor for, I still have some standing, some property. I still own my home, or I at least am able to rent or something like that. But they say to that guy, even though he's basically suffering pretty badly himself, you be the ruler, you be the king. And they're begging him, let this ruin be under thy hand. And so the attempts at obtaining a ruler are basically in vain. The one that was offered the highest government post raises his hand and says, I solemnly decline. Look at verse 7. I will not be a healer. In fact, you see it there. He's actually taking an oath. I swear to God, I will not be a healer. Just look at the verse. In that day shall he swear, saying, I will not be a healer, for in my house is neither bread nor clothing. Make me not a ruler of the people. All right. In other words, his view, which is reality, is that the country is bleeding so badly from an infinite amount of wounds that it's just totally incurable. And he thinks, you think that I'm some kind of a physician, but I'm like the doctor that's called to a patient who can no more be healed. You know, I mean, his condition is, he's terminal, totally helpless or hopeless. And so then notice finally, as a further reason for his refusal, he adds that he himself, together with the rest, are victims of the general misery of hunger and poverty. There's no food in the house. There's barely any clothing left on my back, and we are all in bad shape, and don't try to make me a ruler. Can you imagine? And Israel did come to that several times. Which brings us to verses 8 and 9. And here you have verse 8, for Jerusalem is ruined. That's something called in Hebrew the prophetic perfect tense, as though it was already an accomplished fact, because it wasn't yet. They weren't ruined yet. In fact, they were high on the hog right at the point of the writing. Very, very amazing use of the prophetic perfect there. Jerusalem is ruined, Judah is fallen, verse 8, because their tongue and their doings are against the Lord to provoke the eyes of his glory. And so this is the reason for the wretched condition of these people. And that's the reason for anybody's problems. When you say thumbs down to God, what can you expect? So Jerusalem had run into and stumbled over the stumbling stone, just as David had predicted in the Psalms. Judah had fallen because, its speaking and its actions really provoked the Lord, just provoked him. And his anger was blazing from his all-seeing, holy eyes. And so instead of living uprightly before his countenance, as demanded by the original Mosaic covenant conditions, these people were committing unspeakable, horrible abominations before him, because it's like a snowball that just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and rolling faster and faster and faster till it's just completely a runaway train. It's out of control. That's where our country's going, friends. It really is. They provoke the eyes of his glory. And then notice verse 9, the show of their countenance doth witness against them, and they declare their sin as Sodom. They hide it not. Woe unto their soul, for they have rewarded evil unto themselves. Did you know the face? You know how amazing the human face is? Did you ever think about, sometimes it's so healthy to just think about creation. Think about your anatomy. Did you know that your face is capable of making thousands of different expressions, each one of which will portray on the outside exactly what you are feeling on the inside? Did you know that that could happen? You know it's true. We even have slogans and statements. Say it again. Yeah, well, not only body language, but your face. Your face can think of all the different ways that your face can look when you're embarrassed, when you're sad, when you're exuberant. Whatever your emotion is, your face will accurately portray what's going on inside of you, you see. Or you can try to fake it and portray something different. But your face can, and in this case, this brazen countenance is now being contrasted with the holy countenance of God, in which the God-fearing man really finds his life. So their faces, a girl can look very sensual, right? Amen? You know what I'm talking about. Guys can do the exact same thing. Just look at these album covers, and it always amazes me what winds up on the covers of these CDs of these CCM artists. Just astonishing. All in the name of God. But their sensual faces witness against them. The smirk. You know what a smirk is? Your face can make all these different, and there's like 100 different variations of a smirk that will describe exactly what is going on inside of you. It's a fascinating thing. Their wantonness. That's what wanton means, by the way. That's a KJV word, right? It means sensual, right? That attitude and the real adultery that they're in, it's just written on their faces. How does a man look when he's caught red-handed? Right? Can you mistake that look? You know what that look looks like? You've looked like that at some times, right? And so the face is an amazing thing. And this is what God's nailing them for. The look on your face gives you away. You guys know where you know how guilty you are. It shows all over your face, right? They've shaken off all sense of shame. It's amazing. After Adam sinned, what did he do? He hid himself, right? These people, they refuse to be. They don't even know what shame is. They're so far gone. They live and speak like sodomites, which is why God called them sodomites here in Isaiah. And their glory is in their shame, as Paul says. When the Philippian jailer wanted to take his own life, remember that? What did Paul stopped him? He said, "Do thyself no harm." Now Isaiah cries now, "Woe unto their souls. Woe unto you." They're engaged in murdering their soul and the soul of their own people. Friends, what is all this? Or again, you read through something like this, you're having a devotion, you want to spend some time with the Lord. What should you be getting out of this? How horrible God thinks of sin. Right? And then if you just have to be practical, look what sin does to a human life. Look what it does. Look at the idiot it makes out of you. And you will never know this if you do not spend time in the Word. This is the beauty of spending quality time with God. You get to start thinking His thoughts after Him, and then lo and behold, you start to change. Your life starts changing. Amen. All right, verses 10 and 11. Even in a situation similar to that of Sodom, God says He remembers the righteous, just like He did, even in the case of a compromiser like Lot, right? So it's an amazing thing in verse 10 where God says, "Say ye to the righteous that it shall be well with him." And then here's the reward, "For they shall eat the fruit of their doings." So at the Lord's command, Isaiah's, he's prompted by the Spirit of God to tell the righteous man, basically as a representative of all the righteous people in general, that it's going to be well with them if they have faith enough to live a life that proves that they have faith. And just like Lot in the days of old, the God-fearing people in the future, they're not going to be struck by the judgments. They're not going to be doomed to desolation and complete destruction. In fact, according to God's rewarding justice, they're going to eat the fruits of their own good works. And here you have over and over and over and over again a principle that is prevalent through all 66 books almost. And that is that whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. That's not just in Galatians. I mean, that's everywhere. It's either verbatim by the words I just said, or it's there principially. But it's there, and it's there plenty of times. The laws of reaping and sowing, they're eternally valid. They're valid in every age. And it's on those abiding laws that the whole doctrine of the reward of grace is going to be based, as well as the doctrine of punishment. In fact, even the adversaries of righteousness, people who hate do-gooders, you know, and make fun of them, what was I saying? Even the adversities of the righteous, which are often man, they redound to his well-being and his true spiritual prosperity. All the paths of the Lord are to him mercy and truth. And to this guy, he understands almost seminally, almost internally, Romans 8:28, that God works all things together for the good to them that love him. Jacob might lament that all his bitter experiences are against him. Everything's against me, you know. But exactly the opposite is what's really true. Everything is really for him. Who can harm you, you see? And Peter says to his fellow believers, if ye be followers of that which is good, remember? Well, strictly speaking, nothing or no one can harm a child of God because of the mercilessness of life can, in reality, become God's mercy to him. The very thing that you think is destroying you, God's using that to work in you something that needs to be worked so that you can be a better reflection of his glory and purity. So nothing really can ultimately happen. So ironically, God's mercy to him, his adversities that he goes through, are actually God's opportunities to purify him spiritually, if not physically. Totally different, however, you'll notice in verse 11, is the situation for the one who loves evil and who's called the one who's called wicked here in verse 11. That expresses well the whole idea of this Hebrew word. I remember it when I was studying, rasha. The word even sounds bad, rasha. All right, godless. It means rasha means an unrestriction, no restriction, just have at it. And the same law of righteousness holds true for him, but in an opposite sense. This guy is going to have to eat the fruit of his hands, and in his case, not as the recompense of reward, it'll be the recompense of God's wrath. In fact, 100 years later, approximately 100 years after this, Jeremiah called the attention of his people, his contemporaries, to the exact same irrevocable law that nobody can escape and to which everybody's conscience really has to at some point say yea and amen. Jeremiah 2:19, thine own wickedness shall correct thee, and thy backslidings shall reprove thee. So, God punishes not only because of sin, but he also punishes through sin. The sin itself becomes the punishment, you see. The crimes themselves become the fire that consume the evildoer. And all of the prosperity of the wicked is adversity. Nothing's working to their good. Their eyes might stand out with fatness, but they are fattened for the day of slaughter. It's like very much like what James says in James 5:5. James says to people, you have lived in pleasure and been wanton. You have nourished your hearts in the day of slaughter. Amazing. So these people are reserved unto fire against the day of judgment, according to 2 Peter 3 and verse 7. So you have the Jews, you have ancient Israel, ancient Judah, and then Christendom. They have to be acquainted with this unalterable law of rewarding and punishing, this law of retribution. And I think with regret it should be said that the preaching of stuff like this either doesn't exist at all, or it's so watered down that people just don't get the message. There is this lamentable ignorance concerning the glorious doctrine of the reward of grace that God has attached to the performing of good works. And of course, the only good works that ever count are those done by a redeemed heart. I'm trustful that we understand that much. I'm sure we do. But the same is true of the punishment of wickedness. Even though it might be true, as some say, that Isaiah is quoting here a pair of old proverbs, I think that they nevertheless represent a truth that that really never goes out of style. Notice verse 10, "Say ye to the righteous that it shall be well with him, for they shall eat the fruit of their doings. But woe unto the wicked," verse 11, "it shall be ill with him, for the reward of his hands shall be given him." All right, now, that brings us to verse 12, which basically starts the whole idea of God against feminism. Oh, it really is. Feminism is nothing new in the earth. This is an ancient thing. It actually began in the Garden of Eden. That's a whole nother Bible lesson. But anyway, notice verse 12. "As for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them." That's not considered to be something good. "O my people, they which lead thee cause thee to err, and destroy the way of thy paths." So the heart of the Jew in Isaiah's day was just as wicked as the heart of basically anybody else. Judah's sins were an example and a prelude to all the sins that could be found in the whole world, really up to the end, till time is no more, basically. And so you find in chapter 3 lawlessness, confusion, all the things that we experience in our infinitely secular days in which we live, only on a much larger scale. So let's go back to verse 12 again. It speaks of government being in the hands of children and women that are making really rapid advances at that time, and really in our day like never before. And people have tried to depart from the literal meaning of the verse. I see absolutely really no necessity to do that, because under the last kings of Judah, it was women and children that absolutely got to be in charge of the matters of business in the country most of the time. Remember the Dowager Queen Makah, and remember Athaliah. All right, so these things actually did come to pass. The last kings of Judah were spineless. I think you can prove that they were effeminate, and really not entirely unlike the way a girl would act, or some child. The populace generally remained attached to these horrendous leaders, and they blindly followed them in all of their evil ways. And if you don't believe me, just read Kings and Chronicles. You have evidence after evidence after evidence of that. So the prophet, at the Lord's command, cries out in this holy indignation, "O my people, they which lead thee cause thee to err." That's why the judgment is always worse for the teacher than it is for anybody else. It's good to be obedient, even to hard masters, but woe unto you if you slavishly follow someone into their evil ways, just like Judah did. Judah was like one big nation, like one giant pig with a ring in her nose, being led by horrific people. And what a picture. If the leaders had heard of it, they would have easily accused him of resistance to the government. Isaiah. It took a lot of courage to write this, because he's presenting these leaders as wild animals that devour the paths of justice and make it impossible for people to even find them. And God says that they're going down. They're going to be judged. Now, I don't have my watch on. What time is it? Oh, I see. Okay. This section ends in verse 15, but I think we're going to stop here. In verses 13, 14, and 15, you have another courtroom scene again. Okay, see? The Lord standeth up to plead and standeth to judge the people. You see the courtroom scenario? All right, so that section ends with another courtroom scene. God's been pleading his case, making his case, and then it's time for the trial now. By a solemn announcement of judgment, Isaiah is going to assure that the Lord is preparing himself to act. And so we'll pick it up there next Wednesday night.